Welcome to the FoodJ Podcast, all your news about OpenJDK.
Welcome in part 3 of the JCon interviews. Some time ago I did a book review for the first time, but I didn't meet the author in real life yet. So I was very happy to meet Ottavio Santana for the first time in person in Germany, where he gave a talk about the persistence layer and how you can evolve your career. But of course we also talked about his book, Mastering the Java Virtual Machine. In this podcast, you'll also learn more about Jakarta EE, Glassfish, a pet project with messaging via Telegram, and more. But let's first start with Ottavio.
So my name is Ottavio Santana. I'm from Brazil. Right now I live in Portugal. So what I'm doing here, I come here to help people to understand better soft architecture with Java, especially the persistence layer inside. And that's the main reason to do my presentation today, is talk more about how deep we can go with persistence layer, understand better how the JVM works, and how can affect the job and of course your career.
Okay, your career? So it's not a coding talk, or is it talking about code and how you can be a better developer?
It's mostly about code,
yeah.
Soft architecture as well, so some diagrams. And of course, if you do a good job, you have a chance to get promoted, to understand. My feeling today is a lot of people who want to become a senior and both senior staff, at the staff plus engineer, forget about the basics, especially the code art of understanding the problem, to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are soft engineer. We are solving these issues with code. And of course, I need to show a little bit of code in the meantime. So. Mm-hmm. Most of the time talking about code, how to achieve your career with code.
Yeah. People who follow you online, they can learn a lot about evolving your career. That's one of the things you're working on. You're really helping people. Why are you doing this?
Because somebody helped me in the past. So it's like a gratitude to answer that way to how you can achieve career, a better career with open source. Because open source changed my whole life. I mean, when I was beginning in my city, I had no idea about how the world big is. And right now, thanks to the open source, I can travel, I can go to conference like this, I can increase my network, I can learn, I can achieve more technical skills, softer skills, hard skills, and so on. Everything around open source. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people talk about open source as philosophy. It is fine, it's true. However, in my opinion, open source goes much beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do a better job if you apply the techniques that we learn from open source in your career. For example, do a better code review, understand what's going on, doing your tests, doing integration tests, run with CI, CD, achieving better results, and scalability in your organization, exploring more documentations. And this kind of thing I learned in open source, I applied in my career, and thanks to that, I could move forward in my career. So right now, I'm living in Europe, I'm running my own business because of that.
You have to explain one thing to me. So you're helping people? You're coding, you're doing conferences, you're traveling, and you're writing books. How much hours per day do you sleep?
Yes, I do. That's a question that most of the time I answer. My secret is not doing like every day 8 hours of open source and things like that. No. I try to do my best. I do my best every single day, but at least 10 minutes. Take, for example, learn a new language, English. You can think about, okay, if I learn a single word one day, might be not good enough. But think about 1 year. After 1 year, you are capable to learn 365 words. In a longer term, you can achieve good results. And that's my secret. I do not write the whole book in a single day. I write a small piece every single day. I learn everything about soft engineer every single day. And after 1 year, I can get a better result. Mm-hmm. So the habit to study, the habit to go to the gym, to go to conference like this, is super important. So yeah, it's more about have organized life, a life balance, and do everything, a little step every single day, then try to do a huge step in that day.
Mm-hmm. I had the honor of reviewing one of your books, The Internals of the GVM. Were you a specialist in the GVM, or was it, I want to learn this myself, let's find out, and then write the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, my first contribution was in the OpenJDK at the time that was Java 8 was released. And that was the main reason that I come to the JCP as active member in Soul Java. So I contributed a lot to the OpenJDK. I helped to enhance performance, refactoring some codes. For example, I moved the whole infrastructure code in the Boolean to make sure that we only have two instances of Boolean, true and false, because everything else doesn't make sense. It saved a lot of memory, and it was a single step. I also removed the string buffer to string builder, and it saved a lot of memory. So I did small steps every single day. In the long term, it's become a huge contribution on the OpenJDK. Not because I decided to do every a huge commit in a single day. No, no. I decided to do a small step, little contributions every single day. And after that, I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. So I went to DSRs, then I come to Jakarta EE. And based on that knowledge, I decided to write a book about my experience contributing to my first open source project. That was the OpenJDK.
Yeah. And I invite everyone to go look on GitHub to OpenJDK, because I discovered that it's actually a history book. It has all the information about time zones, for instance, is also in there. So it's a massive amount of work by a lot of people. And like you say, small piece by piece, it's improving.
Yeah, it's improving. A lot of people, when we talk about soft engineer, we talk about new projects, right? So you come here to conference like this, we talk about new technologies. But in reality, of course, you can apply these new technologies, but it's impossible to forget what we've done, what we wrote in the code. And open source in general, we learn about legacy modernization. That means I need to modernize the code that I do have. However, I cannot forget the code that I already wrote, not just myself, but as an organization. And OpenJDK, we did exactly like this. So Java right now has more than 25 years old. And you can see the code refactoring, moving forward, if without breaking a lot of compatibilities. And that's the real life. I mean, the finance, they do have a lot of codes that they need to migrate to Java 8, to Java 21, to Java 22 right now. And it's still a lack, because a lot of people has no idea how to do that, how to achieve that. And you can learn that using open source, because how about open source, especially Java, is about legacy modernization strategy, like exactly what you're doing your job right now.
Yeah.
There were a lot of speakers and visitors who showed interest in Jakarta EE. And I talked with Arjan Thames, Androm Mihaly and Buhaki Sindhi about this topic.
So my name is Arjan Thames, and I'm manning the booth here at the Eclipse Foundation. And I present Jakarta EE and Glasshouse. So that's what brings me to the conference today.
So, and hoping to meet the Java community, I guess?
Yeah, of course. So we always like to talk to the community, ask what they use, ask what they want, how we can help them. So I represent also my company, which is OmniFish. And with OmniFish, we provide support services, consultancy where needed. And if people have issues with Jakarta EE or with Glasshouse specifically, also with other Glasshouse, with other Jakarta EE runtimes, we can help them.
What are the most important evolutions that people should know from the Eclipse Foundation?
The evolutions, like how it
What new things are you supporting and building?
Yeah, so at the moment with the Eclipse Foundation and the Jakarta EE Working Group, we're working towards Jakarta EE 11, which is the second feature release that we're working on. So as maybe people know, or maybe they don't know, Jakarta EE evolved from a Java EE. Java EE had been at Oracle, before that at Sun. It evolved over the years to become like a quite interesting framework. But then at some point, Oracle kind of lost interest in it, or they didn't want to spend so much for it anymore, so they transferred it to the Eclipse Foundation. And that, in a way, was like really good for the community, because a lot of things were like really open source. And the foundation is a vendor neutral thing. Like the Eclipse Foundation is, of course, vendor neutral. So the specifications, the APIs, are the ownership of the Eclipse Foundation. And then companies, vendors, can implement them or can maintain an open source implementation, as we do. But the entire thing is owned by a foundation, and it's open source, and the process is, you could call it an open API process. Like everybody can contribute to evolve the API, and that makes Jakarta EE quite special. And that was a good thing for the community, that they're so open and so vendor neutral. On the other hand, the transfer took a long time.
And people may know it because they had to change package imports from JavaX to Jakarta, correct?
Yes.
But I think a lot of that is also hidden because it's also part of a lot of frameworks. It's also in Spring, I guess.
Yes.
So actually Spring hides a bit that this transition happened within Spring, for instance.
Yeah, so in Spring specifically, Spring hides a couple of things, but also still like applications do import the JavaX namespace. Which means they still have to do the transition. So we have a few, the company, we had a few suggestions about how to change the namespace, how to do that, which tools you could use for that. So if anybody wants to have more details about that, to look it up online.
I guess Open Rewrite is one of them.
Open Rewrite, the Eclipse Transformer, just search and replace is, of course, always an option. It's a bit more,
it's a bit more work,
more careful, a bit more work, but it's still an option if you want to do it manually. If your application is not too big, you can do it that way.
And so we had at some point the transition from JavaX to Jakarta, which was just a drop-in replacement, no new features. Now you say you're going to Jakarta 11.
Yes.
What are the new things coming in there?
Yeah, so we have a lot of good changes in persistence. Jakarta persistence added a lot of new small features, but very convenient to use. We have extended support for JDK 21, the virtual threads in concurrency. It's a bit of a small catch since we also are still compatible with JDK 17. So it's not guaranteed that your application gets a virtual thread, but it's there. With Jakarta validation, this was previously called Bean validation, but now just validation. And we support records with security. Jakarta security is now possible to use multiple authentication mechanisms, which are the things like form or basic or open ID. And we introduced a new handler where you can, it's a bit technical, but you can inject multiple authentication mechanisms like basic or form or maybe two different forms, and then your application can route requests to different mechanisms when needed. It's still a bit manual. The plan was to do it automatically, but the basic foundations are there.
You said the migration to virtual threads, and you have to be on Java 21 for that. Do you think Java 21 will be picked up faster compared to previous versions because of that kind of evolutions, like virtual threads?
I do think so. At least I hope so, for starters. And there's always a bit of a debate in the community. How do we get people to JDK 21 or to newer JDKs in general? So there's two groups of people, basically, within the community, within the vendor and library community. One says, okay, well, we have to support everything, so we support even down to JDK 6 if possible. Others say, well, we need to be an example, and we need to change to newer JDK versions faster. So we kind of smooth the path and give people a reason to upgrade. If everything stays compatible with JDK 6 for ages, then people and companies might not feel the pressure to update so much, and then the entire ecosystem stays at JDK 6.
Yeah.
Or in this case, maybe JDK 8.
Yeah.
So then we forcefully say, okay, well, now the minimum is going to be JDK 11 or JDK 17, and then it gives people more of an impulse to upgrade.
Yeah, I know it's a very difficult decision for a lot of companies who have legacy applications, but on the other hand, you have developer improvements, you have code improvements, you have runtime improvements.
Yes, exactly.
So there are very good reasons to upgrade.
Yeah, very good reasons. And we had this with the update in Jakarta EE 11 to JDK 17 as a minimum. And of course, some people ask, well, you have this API like Jakarta Persistence, and there's nothing in the API that requires JDK 17. The API is just, it doesn't use JDK 17 features. You can compile the API, I think, still with JDK 7, probably. Okay. But then, of course, the reason is that there's a guarantee that all implementations are at least JDK 17.
Can work with it.
So by limiting what you support as a spec, you actually give more guarantees.
Yeah.
And there's this balance that not always everybody understands, or maybe they do understand, but they have different reasons. But as a spec, the tighter you are, the less things you support, the more guarantees you give. So if you would say, okay, well, we do the spec at JDK 21, then you would have the guarantee that every implementation supports JDK 21, because that's the minimum. Currently, we are at 17 and 21. So whenever you have a generic Jakarta EE application or a library, you can't compile it to JDK 21 because it will not work on those systems that use JDK 17.
Hello, I'm Andrzej Mihaly. I'm came here from my company OmniFish to support the Eclipse Foundation booth and Jakarta EE. And we're also involved in the Eclipse Glassfish project. So that's what we're going to promote here. And we're basically a company that is a Jakarta EE member. So we're involved with a lot of Jakarta EE activities. And we are involved in Eclipse Glassfish, what I already said. But we also provide support for Eclipse Glassfish for companies that use it. We built a new runtime based on Glassfish components, which kind of aims to provide an alternative to Quarkus, Helidon, and Spring Boot in the area of Jakarta EE with all the Jakarta EE APIs. And we're here just to help and talk to anybody who's using Jakarta EE and gather feedback of what they think about it and how to make it better.
I've never used Glassfish before. What should I know about it? What does it offer me as a Java developer?
Okay, so Glassfish is an application server, but it's more than that. Like nowadays, many people think that application servers are obsolete and they don't need them. That might be true in some cases. In other cases, you still can benefit from clustering, administration console, and a lot of things like transactions provided to your application that you don't need to care about. Also, monitoring is there. A lot of things that you don't need to build into your application. It's just there when you run your application with Glassfish. But you can now also embed Glassfish in the same way as embed Tomcat. You know, Spring Boot by default embeds Tomcat to run the application. So you can do the same with Glassfish and still benefit from all the services that it provides that you don't have to build into your application. And it still provides the whole Jakarta EE APIs. So if you have a Jakarta EE application, a WAR or ER, you can still run it with this embedded version of Glassfish.
So yeah, most people are not aware of it, but Spring uses Tomcat inside. You can change it with Jetty, for instance, which is also another web server. So Glassfish has other benefits compared to Tomcat.
Yes, it does, but mostly for Jakarta EE applications. So Spring Boot uses some parts of Jakarta EE, but most of the things are not compatible with Jakarta EE. So if you run a Spring Boot application on Glassfish, you can still have some benefits of monitoring and troubleshooting options there. But it doesn't give you so much if so much more than Tomcat.
Yeah.
If you have a Jakarta E application, then you can have less code in the application than in the Spring Boot application. And then you can run it, or you can embed Glassfish, and you have a lot of these because Glassfish will understand your application better.
Mm-hmm. A lot of developers go to Spring because they know that's the best. It's used a lot. What is the advantage of going to Jakarta EE?
The advantage is that you can choose the runtime. That's one thing that most people don't really realize and don't even see the value in it because they are happy with Spring. But maybe then they face some situation where Spring is not the perfect case. Like in IoT devices, you need to have a really small, mm-hmm. small application, or serverless, you need to start your application very fast. And that's where Spring is okay, but doesn't excel. With Jakarta E, if you write a Jakarta E application, you have the option to choose the runtime you run it on. And these runtimes are compatible more or less. Maybe you will need to tweak some things or refactor some things that are not standard, but it's very likely that you will have, with little work, you will be able to run your application on any of these. Mm-hmm. But in reality, you usually target some runtime, so you don't have to really migrate between runtimes, but you have the option to reuse your knowledge. So if you learn Jakarta EE platform, the APIs and the specification, you can run an application that scale in big clusters and on application servers, but the same with the same knowledge, you can write small applications if you choose a small runtime that even supports native compilation like Quarkus, then you can reuse your knowledge, build the application and get something completely different mm-hmm. than with application servers or with Spring Boot.
I'm working on a few blog posts about Java being able to handle from the edge devices up to the biggest cloud environments. And that's actually what you're saying. If you have an edge device, which is, for instance, collecting data from sensors, and you want to process that before you send it to the cloud, there you could have a Jakarta EE application running on a small device, for instance.
Yes, provided that there is a runtime that is small enough and fast enough to run on these IoT devices.
Yeah.
For a long time, there was no such runtime, but recently there are some runtimes that support that, like Quarkus. There's also Helidon, which is sort of, they don't support all the Jakarta EE mm-hmm. APIs, but much more than Spring does, for example. They try to support or at least the relevant parts of Jakarta EE for their use case. We're building a new framework, Pira, or it's not so new anymore, but it's still not mature enough to compare it to Quarkus. It's called Piranha. It's based on Glassfish components, and it's very small, or at least you can combine only, take only those parts of Jakarta EE you need, and you can make it very small and fast, like in 200, 300 milliseconds, if you really shave it to the basic. And with these runtimes, you can really run on IoT devices very comfortably with things that don't require much memory, that don't require too much CPU to start, and also on serverless, which is sort of like IoT devices, because there you can have a lot of memory, but then you still care about starting your applications very fast, because it may be started for every request, and then you don't have to slow down every request. So now you have these options. It's a pity that for Jakarta EE, for a long time, there were not so good options. Like for a couple of years ago, I think five years ago, there were no good options like mm-hmm. this. But since Quarkus and Piranha and Helidon started, you now have a lot of options with the same Jakarta EE API to build small applications.
Yeah. My name is Bohake Sindi. I'm from South Africa. Right now it's spring, so it's autumn. It's gonna go to winter soon. And what brings me to JCon is there was a call for paper, and I wrote, and then I got accepted.
Surprise!
Normally I'd see the list, and I'm like, these are smart people. So I'm like, okay. So it's interesting, yeah. But it's not my first time. This is my second time here.
And what is the topic of your talk?
My topic is basically embracing Jakarta EE in the cloud with real-world example, because I've noticed, like, there's a lot of tutorials and a lot of, especially with colleagues and teams, when you talk about enterprise Java, they're like, no, go Spring, it's easier, it's a Spring Cloud and all of that stuff. And then when you go around to figure out how to do it with Java EE or Jakarta EE, it's like simple tutorials. So I said, no, man, we've done this before. So let's take the latest version of Jakarta EE, create an application with a database that talks to a third-party services, all of that stuff. And then let's deploy it in the cloud.
Yeah.
So I couldn't care which cloud provider available, but then over time, as I was trying to figure out which cloud provider to use, I found out that, you know what, Azure is much detailed. There was one or two hiccups, but after rereading the tutorials, you're like, okay, this is what I was missing, and then got it right.
We talked about Jakarta EE before today, yeah. That you can indeed make your application a lot smaller.
Yes.
If you just go for Jakarta instead of Spring, for instance.
That's the reason I didn't go for Spring, because I tried my previous experiences. Developers like to mix Java EE and Spring frameworks together just to create a solution, and then it always backfires because like the life cycles are totally different. Mm-hmm. And then when I decided, let me try Spring full out and understand it. So I tried to write, you know, like a simple page that says "Hello World" on a JSP page, and it was 300 megs. And also in South Africa, we don't have very high fast internet speed like here. So if you're trying to deploy your application in production and you're on a network, you always get a timeout. So I said, why are we struggling with these things? With Java EE, you can write a simple application, couple of megs, deploy it within seconds, and then it's done. Mm-hmm. So ever since that, I was like, Java EE all the way. So it's been almost 20 years, so.
And they were mentioned about Helidon, Quarkus, other frameworks on top of Jakarta.
Yeah.
Did you use those, or Jakarta is enough for you?
For now, Jakarta frameworks is more than efficient to use. Unless you write a microservices and you need some new micro profile features. But other than that, a lot of enterprises application today are just usually web front-end that talks to the database or some third-party. Nowadays, people like to use NoSQL. I think with Jakarta EE 11, with JNoSQL coming in, then you pretty much have everything standardized in the box. And the beauty about Jakarta EE, whatever container you use, it's already got a built-in default implementation, so you don't have to worry about am I going to use Hibernate, or am I going to use Eclipse Link, or what kind of in-memory database do I have to use? You can use already something that's in-memory standard, and they just write your application. That's why I always tell my people, just focus on creating the application. Mm-hmm. Let the container handle the rest.
So you mentioned you are from South Africa.
Yeah.
One of the earlier Fuji podcasts, we had a session about the jugs in South Africa. We had Cape Town and Johannesburg.
Yeah, Josie Jug.
Yeah, Josie Jug, indeed. I forgot the name.
Yeah.
Very bad with names, sorry. Are you a member of one of those jugs, or do you live too far away from them?
No. I know the guys, Corne, Rory. Yeah, I attend all the jugs in, well, I can't attend Cape Town because then you have to fly. But in Johannesburg, it's the last Monday of every month, and there's always a jug session. There's a meetup, and I'm trying to promote it. A couple of weeks ago, I promoted it. No, last week.
Yeah.
Josie Gar for Java developers in one of the conferences that sessions, you know, that was happening in South Africa. So I said, no, if you're a Java developer and you want to try and you want to be a speaker, go to a Josie Jug and try and present. At least it's a small groups, people will give you feedback so that you don't have to come to a cinema, there's like 600 people, and then you get nerves. So, yeah.
That's actually a nice point that we didn't mention before. So we already talked about the JUX, and it's important to that people know that JUX exists.
Yeah.
But you have a very valid point. A JUX can also be a starting point to become a speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that also what you did? Did you present first at a JUX, or did you just submit to a conference and got accepted?
No. Actually, funny enough, I tried to do talks in South Africa first, but I actually didn't even realize I should have actually tried from the JUX.
Mm-hmm.
And I was declined. So I was online on X, formerly Twitter, and people were like, "Hey, man, there's a lot of conferences and call for speakers. Try one."
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, where's all the JUX ones? I applied, and JCOM was the first one to accept. And I'm like, wow, the same talk that I wanted to talk in South Africa got rejected.
Got you to Germany.
And I flew to Germany. And I thought, probably 50 people, nobody knows me. Jeez, it was packed. And I'm like, oh my word. So I had to like...
And did you enjoy it?
No, I always enjoyed it. It's, look, you always learn by jumping in the deep end. So it's a good experience. And I always tell people, like, if you have the desire to want to talk, or, you know, everybody's got knowledge. Knowledge sharing is important. So I tried blogging, and the problem is you overthink a lot, at least with a talk. Once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's always going to live forever in online somewhere.
I already talked with my next guest, Patrick Baumgartner, in podcast 46 about the JUX and Java community in Switzerland. At JCon, we met again, where Patrick gave a talk about a pet project.
Hello, everyone. My name is Patrick Baumgartner. I'm from Switzerland, and I'm here at JCon to do a talk tomorrow morning. And obviously, another reason would be actually like to meet the whole Java community here, which is actually always a pleasure to see friends. Yeah,
we already had quite a few guests from Switzerland. Is there a close connection with JCon, or is this just the closest conference that you can go to?
No, that's not true. I would say like JCon has a train connection, which is like roughly for most of us like 6 or 7 hours by train.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to fly. So that's nice. And in Switzerland, there are not that many Java conferences. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like one of those would be Vox Day Zurich, of course, yeah. Right?
Okay. I see you have a speaker badge.
Yeah.
That means you have a talk.
Yes. I'm going tomorrow to talk about a pet project, because I once had the idea I should do a talk about something, what you could do like on a side project and learn actually like what something you could learn for work actually. So I have an example built up like 2 years ago or something like that, where I created an application because I was tired of an Android app, which was really heavyweight and difficult to use. So I wrote an application which deals with a Telegram bot, and I used that to kind of like the Telegram bot to send messages, and then use this kind of messages I send and display it like as a digital postcard on a display. And I have set up it in a way that you have kind of end-to-end everything. So it's like automatic build, automatic deployment, and things like that. And it was actually quite fun, because I realized, first, I did it for me because I was tired of using this heavyweight Android app, which took me way too long to send these digital postcards. And then actually, like, my family started to use it. And then I realized, I build software, but it's not for me. They have, like, different needs. And now I have different needs. And then other things happened, like, for example, that spam arrived at the Telegram bot. And now the spam messages were sent as well to the display, you know? So, quite a lot of things. Yes, I got hacked. And then I had to implement kind of filters. But, you know, like, there is another problem when you do private things. It's also like putting emojis on a canvas in a Docker container. It's not possible, because a Docker container with build packs does not have an emoji font.
Yeah.
So you always see like running on your machine, but when you deploy it, it's not working. And it took me quite a while to find out actually like why. And then second, actually, like how to fix it. Yeah.
Isn't that the story of all pet projects? It's a good idea, and then it becomes too big.
I guess so.
But you learn.
Yeah, you learn quite a lot. I mean, I learned like how to patch my run images of the build packs. I learned of like the needs of like the family or the extended family, and also like my needs as well, to see like if somebody sends a message, I want to see it as well, even if I'm not at home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was quite an interesting route, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. You use messages. Is there some messaging system in between, or?
Well, actually, the Telegram bot receives a message, and like the library I'm using is basically just polling the Telegram environment, and this way you receive kind of messages. I use them internally also as messages. Yeah.
So a Java library to interact with Telegram.
Yeah, exactly. And it's quite interesting because, like WhatsApp and Signal, there is also libraries for those, which are based on their web client. So it's kind of a wrapper for those. But Telegram has a proper API. You probably have seen that you can do games and other things. So they really like created something way bigger and with much more possibilities, which is actually quite interesting. And that's why you have like channels, or you can write bots in channels, but also like bots you can talk to directly. You can write your personal bot. So I think it's like, I would say like nowadays, it's more like for the old guys, it would be a command line application. Now you use a Telegram bot, I would say, yeah.
So actually you're using Telegram as a message bus.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But you don't need to pay for the hosting.
That's true. But a fun fact regarding hosting was also like for my pet project, I found out that I can run Docker container on my NAS at home.
Yeah.
So it's super cheap. It's basically for free because the NAS is actually also running.
Right there.
And even like the optimization, how to deploy it there is also super smooth. And so that's also something you don't have to pay always like at the cloud provider for your application. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there Raspberry Pis involved somewhere?
No, not at all. It's super simple. It's just a Spring Boot app. And I try to, usually I run another talk where I show people like how to optimize your Spring Boot app so that you can start up like in half of the time, use more than like 30% less RAM, have more throughput and stuff like that. And this is also kind of an application where I apply those things as well, you know.
So again, your professional knowledge.
I think it goes both ways.
Both ways, yeah. Do you think it's important as a developer to have pet projects?
Of course. And this will be also like one of the main message tomorrow lunchtime, because the thing is actually like every developer should have a pet project, but it's not my current project I work on, the one which goes to production, because that's like way too risky if everyone has like his pet projects built in there. But I think we should be ready for future challenges. And we should actually have a pet project to do something that can be within the company, but that can be also something in your free time. So yeah, definitely everyone should have a playground where you can play safely, do your experiment, and maybe throw it away or not. So sometimes you have ideas which become like good open source projects or whatever, you know.
So you use it to experiment with new technologies,
yeah,
other technologies that you didn't use yet in
exactly.
production.
Actually also to learn, right?
Yeah.
So if your manager tells you, or like your product owner or whoever tells you, we are going to do this, you have already some pre-knowledge on something, or at least like you have read about it, you know how it could work, you know, to get some ideas. So I think that time spent on those projects is very important to just like prepare you for the future. Mm.
Actually, it's a bit of my story, personal story. I experimented with Java and Raspberry Pi, wrote a book, wrote articles, and then ended up even with a new job.
Okay, of course, sure.
And that's something which can happen because you get involved into an open source project, for instance.
Exactly.
And what other talks will you visit at the conference, or did you already visit?
Actually, I arrived just like after lunchtime, so I just had some good chats. And I haven't visited any talks yet, but I will definitely participate tomorrow morning in the talks.
Yeah. A story I hear a lot here is the community is even more important than the talks for a lot of people.
I mean, there is no FOMO because the talks are recorded and you can watch if you want it afterwards. So, so why not use the time to like mingle with people, talk about things and so on. So that's like the opportunity to meet each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even like for me personally, things have changed over, I would say, maybe the last 10 years. Maybe I was a participant like more than 10 years, 15 years ago on conferences, and I was just a regular participant. But when I started doing talks, I met people, and I'm now happy to meet them again, and they became friends over time. So basically, it's like visiting friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually nice. And then sometimes, and that happens actually, like where you sit together and say, let's collaborate on something together. Let's do like a workshop or a talk on that topic for the next conference and things like that. So, yeah, so that's actually nice to see all these people around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice conclusion.
That's it for part three of the JCon interviews. Two more to come. Next week, you'll hear Gerrit Groenwald, Piotr Przybyl, Balkrishna Raoul, François Martin and Anne-Laure Egger about garbage collectors, Azul Intelligence Cloud, test containers and flaky tests, ToxiProxy, structured concurrency, virtual threats, being a volunteer at JCon, and much more. See you!
Give me a foo, give me a J, give me the friends of OpenJDK.